Hybrid languages. What are they? How do we create them? And when do we use them? Today we're speaking to Ridian, Melissa, and Hussein. You're listening to Crossing the Globe from Beaver Sound, where we examine an issue from the unique eyes of the LSE international students. Our first guest today is Ridian, who is from Wales, and he is a second year politics student. Hi, Ridian, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi there, thanks for having me.
So, do you want to start off by talking about where you're from?
Yeah, so I'm from a city called Swansea in Wales, which is just next to England, but very distinct in terms of its language, culture, and I speak Welsh as a first language. So Welsh is a language that has historically developed separately to English, but as sort of imperial effort to sort of impose English and sort of as globalization has occurred, Welsh has kind of been pushed to the fringes. And in my city, Welsh isn't really the predominant language. Only about 20% speak it there. And it kind of reflects the 20% that speak it across Wales. But mainly the language is in the rural areas. And I spoke it at home. I didn't speak English for a few years as I was growing up, and learnt Welsh quite naturally with my parents and my grandparents. And when I went to school then, I went to a Welsh language school. There, we kind of have a mix of people who have learnt it at home and speak it at home fluently, and people who are learning the language for the first time as they're in primary school. And in my school itself, I was in the sort of 5% of my school that spoke Welsh at home and didn't have to learn it from scratch in school, so kind of in a Bernie Sanders style elite there. But yeah.
So was there a cultural difference, would you say, in between the 95% and the 5%?
So I'd say it kind of just depends a little bit on attitudes that everybody has towards the language. There are plenty of people who learned the language for the first time in school and really sort of developed a passion for it and developed this attachment to the language, which is really great, and kind of been exposed to all the different cultural differences and great culture that we have within the Welsh language. And also there's a lot of people on the other side who might have started off speaking Welsh, and just as they've gone into the workplace or they've made new friends that maybe don't speak the language, they've kind of let go of that tradition, that culture a little bit. Yeah.
Okay, that's really interesting. So obviously Wenglish, which is like the hybrid language, the fusion of English and Welsh,
yeah,
is not a written language, but would you text in Wenglish?
So I think, yes, I definitely would. And I probably do it to most people that I text in Welsh. And the main reason for that is that we live in a world where English is sort of the norm in terms of technology. And trying to adapt a language which is very unique in its in the way that it's structured and doesn't have that much English influence despite its proximity to England, really does affect your ability to use it in technology. And that's where it kind of, I'd say in the last few years, this idea of a hybrid language with Welsh has really surfaced. And that is because trying to sort of balance speaking a language which is easiest to you in terms of being your first language, and then trying to balance that with speaking quite quickly online with words that you might not sort of, with new words that are sort of unique to the internet and to you know, acronyms and things like that, it gets hard to sort of try and compensate those two. And yeah, it makes for a curious combination of words and structures that you wouldn't really get maybe speaking to someone in person.
So if I was to text you in Wenglish, how would you say, or how would I say something like, Hey, Rudian, do you want to grab coffee after our lecture? How would you say that in English?
I'd probably say something like, hey, Tisha, grab a coffee, Rudian.
Okay, that's really cool. Are there certain words that you would usually say in English when you'd be texting or speaking to someone in English?
100%, yeah. And that's, it's usually the more complicated words and words that you might not have in this formal aspect of the language, the words that are more unique to social surroundings and stuff.
So are there specific words when you'd be speaking Wenglish that would be in English? Or is there like a pattern for specific words that would always surface in English instead of Welsh?
So it really depends on the sort of situation that you're in when you're speaking the language. And it's to do with the sort of words that you might not be familiar with in Welsh, and just because it's the sort of language where there is a sort of conflict between accessibility and new words that people can all recognize when we're trying to sort of create these new words and expressions that match English ones and match other languages as well, and then that with sort of maintaining the historical formal aspects of the language and, you know, staying pure and true to the roots of the language. No, but words that are unfamiliar or casual, so words that you're saying quite quickly, expressions like I'm going for a run, I'm catching a flight, I'm gonna be late. It's just things that are maybe a little bit less formal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I find a similar sort of thing between Finnish and English, actually. And a lot of my friends would make a specific point about speaking English, even though they were born in Finland and grew up in Finland. But it's almost seen as this thing that's very kind of like cool and hip to do, to English word drop into conversations. So would you say it's the same thing with Wenglish, or is it like the opposite? Like, does it kind of, are you like compromising Welsh by speaking Wenglish?
Yeah, I'd say there's aspects of both. There's definitely this attitude that using English words in Welsh sentences isn't really cool, but rather it's sort of taking away from the Welsh language itself and taking away from the uniqueness of it, and kind of like reminds people of a threat of the language sort of being subsumed by English. But on the other hand as well, there are people who really want to make sure that the Welsh language is as accessible as possible, and that through putting in English words that if they were in Welsh might be a bit hard to understand, or really that there's just no sort of consensus over what to use, there might be a confusion then that sort of prevents people from having the confidence to speak Welsh in everyday conversations. So I think it's really trying to find the balance between those two conflicts.
That's really interesting. And just to kind of round off, how does speaking Welsh affect your identity?
It makes my identity complete, I'd say. I think that speaking Welsh really just gives you an insight into a really amazing world of culture, literature, language that otherwise would be kept a secret.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Now we're going to be speaking to Melissa from Hong Kong, who is a third year IR student. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
So could you start off by talking a little bit about your background and where you're from?
So I'm from Hong Kong, but I grew up in Shanghai and I went to an American school. So I have an American accent, but I speak English, Mandarin and Cantonese with varying fluencies. And I learned French somewhere in my teens.
Did you learn all these languages at home or was it more through school?
So my parents spoke Cantonese to me when I was a kid. But I started learning Mandarin and English pretty much simultaneously. There are points where I can remember learning English, but I don't actually really remember, you know, sitting down and learning Mandarin or Cantonese. English was kind of my academic language, the language of my school, and then we spoke a mix of Cantonese and English at home, and Mandarin was kind of the language that fit into all the spaces outside of these areas.
So would you say that there were different contexts that you would speak these languages in, or like different, like certain people that you would speak them with and not other people?
Yeah, because obviously the amount of people I could speak Cantonese to were limited. Cantonese has really remained a language of the home, and there are some things, you know, like, you know, my parents would yell at me in Cantonese because they didn't want to yell at me in English, but there are certain words in Cantonese I now know that I could never speak in English, and these include, say, like, things about cooking or eating that often, because Hong Kong is really a city of food. It's kind of our love language is food. So there are a lot of things that are to do with food that I can't really express in English, that I can only express in Cantonese. Whereas because I did a lot of classes, like I did ballet and piano in Mandarin, there are parts of my body that I don't know how to say in English, but I don't know necessarily what the exact part is in Mandarin, but if someone should tell me something about that body part, I would be able to know what they were talking about without actually knowing what specific thing they were talking about.
Do you have certain feelings that you can only express in one language and not in another language?
Yeah, there are some things that I have trouble expressing in different languages, and there are some things I have trouble expressing in any language at all. So I remember, like, going around recently, there's been this thing about how some people have internal monologue and some people don't, and I kind of have both an internal monologue and not. And while my internal monologue, when I have it, is usually in English, when I don't, it's kind of this abstract thought or feeling that I have that I then have to express into words. But putting it to words is sometimes harder than it sounds like, because I'm not sure what language I'm thinking in, and therefore I'll have bits and pieces of different languages just pop up in a sentence, then I'll have to kind of translate it in my head before I say it out loud.
Would you ever kind of construct a hybrid language between French and Cantonese, or were those two always separate for you?
So for me, my hybrid languages came out specifically because of the context I was using them in. So Cantonese and English, for example, because I was speaking Cantonese and English at home, and then they would kind of mesh together. And sometimes there are just better ways of expressing things in English. For example, the adding of ing to make it a verb. So I just say something in, I say like a noun in Cantonese and add ing at the end of it to make it a verb, which is very, it's actually quite a Cantonese thing to do, because Cantonese is pretty much a hybrid language at this point. But I never had a context where I would be speaking French and English together. But the funny thing is in first year here, I was learning Arabic, and because my teacher would spend a lot of time explaining certain sounds in Arabic using the French sound system, I ended up thinking about French and Arabic together. And so I had a bit of a hybrid language between French and Arabic, despite not really speaking Arabic.
That's really cool. I was also asking all of the people on this podcast to say how they would translate if I were to say, hey Melissa, do you want to get coffee after our lecture? How would you say that as like a mix between Cantonese and English, for example?
So the thing is, like, Cantonese itself, the Cantonese that is spoken in Hong Kong by a lot of youngsters is already kind of mixed, and obviously some things are mixed previously. So for example, the word coffee is just cafe, because it was just kind of appropriated by the Cantonese, by kind of how, you know, tsunami is tsunami, even though that's a Japanese word. But that specific, like, phrase, we wouldn't really kind of, you know, mix it up, because there was no real need. I think my hybrid language really arised from a need that I couldn't speak specific terms in either languages. So, like, let's grab a cup of coffee, and be like, ode hoi la boi cafe. So coffee, obviously, you can get from English, from coffee. Right. But everything else in the specific sentence, I wouldn't, you know.
That's so interesting. Yeah, so we talked before a bit about the differences between using languages in a more professional, kind of like a business setting, and a more casual setting, or like if you're talking to your friends and things like that. How does your language know-how translate to those two situations?
So if you were to categorize someone being fluent, as, you know, a lot of job applications do, is that they're able to hold a conversation about the business in that language, I don't think I'd be fluent in any language, because this isn't really something I can do in English either. Obviously, there are things I know a bit more of because I studied academically in English, so I know bits of econ, which means that I know what a balance sheet is in English. But I wouldn't be able to, you know, get a job, because according to the job constraints, I'm not fluent in what they need.
And I guess that kind of, like, relates back to what you were saying about having really strong vocabularies, for example, in something like food and cooking in Cantonese, and then you wouldn't necessarily have those same words or be able to express yourself in the same ways in English. Sometimes when I can't find a specific word, like the right word that I'm looking for in Finnish, I would replace that one word by like a description of like with like 10 words in Finnish instead of that one word that I'm looking for that I know exists, but I just don't know what the word is. Do you get that as well?
Yeah, definitely. And I think this also comes back into like the monologue thing, where there are times in English or in Cantonese where I'm not thinking in terms of words, I'm thinking in terms of feelings. And I think that really has just gotten me to practice it a lot more. I think I used to be a lot worse at it, especially when I first came to London and I had to be speaking. All my friends growing up in Shanghai, they were able to speak bits of Mandarin, if not fluently in Mandarin, and they understood bits of Cantonese probably as well. So we were able to understand each other if we just input a few words of Mandarin here or there. So I didn't really ever have to translate it in my head. But there comes a time where I'll be like, for example, I've recently gotten really into cooking. We eat a lot of kind of soups at home, and so I've gotten into trying to recreate these soups. But obviously these are all dried ingredients that aren't used in the West. It's not like chicken that you use in both the East and the West. It's just these ingredients. And so when I'm trying to kind of say, oh, what this ingredient is, I don't know what it is, but I can just tell you what it will add to, you know, the soup, or what kind of characteristics it will add, what kind of benefits it will add. The name isn't going to say anything. If I say I put a date in my soup, it's not going to mean anything to you. If I tell you, oh, I do it so it can add sweetness, so it can add, you know, it's supposed to be good for your heart or whatever, then that's already more informative than just saying I'm putting dried dates in my soup.
That is actually super interesting. Are there certain banks of words that you can't translate into English from Cantonese? Or like certain things like flavors that you just can't express that with, like, because in English, like a lot of the time, obviously we use like sweet and salty and savory and spicy and things like that. Are there certain tastes for food that you expand beyond like our understanding in English of taste?
I think maybe not necessarily expand. So I think another thing that we do in Cantonese a lot is that we have words that kind of encompass a lot of meanings. So, you know, your word, we have this word that kind of means sticky. And it's like, yeah, if you say it in terms of sticky, if you translate sticky to this word in Cantonese, it makes sense. But you can also use it in like a wide variety of things, like the way something feels in your throat. And it's like, there's this like kind of comparison, like trying to explain to a fish what air feels like, because they've never had this concept of air before, therefore they won't even need the language for air. Whereas like, I guess because our foods tend to stick in our throats a bit, and it's kind of sticky but not quite, and it's really hard to explain what it is, because
yeah,
you don't really talk about this in English. And I suppose the only way to do it would be to feed someone this kind of food, where it's like, how would you describe this? And even so, they'd probably be like, oh, it's sweet, it's thick, kind of, instead of this one specific word that we're thinking about. There's this word in Cantonese that kind of means chaotic, I guess, but it's like kind of saying also lazy, like this mess that you've created. But I don't think this word exists in English, so it's just kind of, how do you define yourself when you don't have the words to define yourself?
That must be so annoying though as well, because then you're like, I know exactly what I have to say, but I just can't say it. We also briefly spoke about Shanghainese and a class issue around that before we started recording the podcast. Do you kind of want to keep on talking about that a little bit? Because that was super interesting.
Growing up, I had this bus monitor for a few years that was from Shanghai, because I grew up in Shanghai, and she would speak Shanghainese to us. So I spoke like a smattering of Shanghainese growing up. And it's this weird thing where it's actually really useful to speak a lot of dialects, but no one who is, you know, for lack of a better word, properly educated, someone that kind of would come to LSE, would be the kind of person who would be able to speak many of these dialects, because when you're more educated, you're speaking English and, you know, Mandarin with a good accent. The other thing is that we used to go to these tutors, and these tutors all had the accents that we like, that, you know, are the most understandable, or say, whereas a lot of the times we'd have maids who are from, you know, other parts of China who don't have those super nice accents. And it's interesting to see kind of how I remember my accent changing when I was a kid because of the people that we're talking to. So when I was talking to the maid from this province, I would be speaking with her kind of accent. And I think there is a bit of, you know, you want your kids to be speaking with the best accent. Like, you want your kids to be speaking with a nice London accent instead of somewhere else. And that's, I don't know if I really have a point with this, but I think it was just interesting to see how these things play out, and, you know, about how language is not an apolitical thing. It's a thing that very much is played out over class lines and, to some degree, ethnic lines.
Do you feel like there's pressure on you to dehybridize maybe your speaking?
Yeah, I think there has been, like, in recent years, you know, a nationalization movement on every single front, except in Hong Kong, where they've kind of meshed together. A lot of the work I do often in office is actually just translation work, which is kind of funny to do with languages. I think I would always find it a bit more stressful to work in any language that wasn't English at this point, because I have a much longer history of working in these kind of words in English, you know, words like balance sheet that I've learned in English a long time before I've learned it in Cantonese or Mandarin. And I think maybe eventually I would be more comfortable. But I just really like the ability for me to express myself in multiple languages, because when one language fails, there's always another. There's this thing that people say that, you know, you think differently in different languages. And I do think that's true. I think partially because obviously I learned academics in English, and so I have a lot of kind of restraint that was instilled by my school to, you know, you have to raise your hand before you speak. And I find that I'm a bit more reserved in English, whereas I'm a bit more kind of, because I learned Cantonese entirely with my family, so it's kind of just, there's a lot more joking around that goes to Cantonese, which obviously isn't the best thing to do in an office, but I find that is kind of more my instinct to do when I'm speaking Cantonese or when I'm thinking in Cantonese.
That's really cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah, hope that was good. Thank you.
Finally, we are speaking to Hussein from Pakistan, who is a third-year economics student. Hi, Hussein.
Hi.
So do you want to start off by talking a bit about your background and where you grew up and things like that?
Yeah, sure. So I'm originally from Pakistan. I was born in Karachi. I lived there for 5 years, and then I moved to Bahrain, which is not many people have actually heard of it. It's like a small island in the Middle East, and I lived there for about like 15 years. My family's still there. And yeah, so I grew up speaking Urdu predominantly, with, like, especially at home. So I never really got that exposure to it in school. And I used to converse in English, like, in school.
When you moved to London, did you kind of start speaking this hybrid language more?
Yeah, so the hybrid language comes in, I think, not just in London, but in Bahrain as well, because I had Pakistani friends there as well. So whenever I'm speaking at home, it's just in Urdu, without any hybrid language. But at the same time, my Urdu isn't, like, I haven't been exposed to lots of different Urdu literature, or my vocabulary isn't as good as it is in English, right? Because the way that you develop vocabulary in a language is not just through your parents, but also through reading books or newspapers. So whenever I talk to my parents, I'm relying solely on Urdu, but it's conversing in a using very simple words, which I found, like, very interesting, because I'm explaining, like, I'm talking to them in a breadth of, like, complex topics that I go through, but I'm still using Urdu to converse. And with my friends, it's different in the sense that, yeah, the hybrid language started coming in when I was talking to my friends in Urdu, because that's when I realized that there's certain words that even when you know the word in Urdu for it, it just sounds so formalized and regal sounding that you automatically, like, talk yourself into substituting it for an easier English word, which I find interesting, because it's like your brain is subconsciously telling you to hold back on using that word even though you know it. The hybrid of Urdu and English, especially as form, not just because people don't know the vocabulary, but also because maybe they subconsciously substitute certain words for English on purpose.
That's super interesting, because Urdu is also a beautiful language to listen to.
Exactly. It's sad because English is supposed to be a practical language, because it's a language of business. Like, it's inevitable that you have to learn it when you're living in the 21st century, right? It's an international world. So English should be the practical language, and Urdu should be the language that's conveying, you know, sense of familiarity, or when you're talking with your friends or your family. But it's, like, turned the other way around, especially in the younger generations.
Does that translate to something like poetry or literature, even though you mentioned that you're not super, like, familiar or like, comfortable with
So in reading. Terms of... So, yeah, the production of culture has changed, especially in Pakistan. And I think the consumption has shifted from like older generations to younger generations, right? And the type of culture that's coming out isn't necessarily always in pure Urdu. There is obviously a large amount of people in Pakistan that still listen to Urdu poetry, and there's still literature festivals surrounding it. But you don't see that same level of prevalence or interest in it as much as it used to be in the older generations. And I think that's largely because, first of all, most of the people that come from, and especially, again, this turns into a class issue, like the people that are from the upper classes or the upper middle classes, some of them literally can't understand it. That's how bad the situation has become, where we say hybrid, but hybrid indicates like there's an equal component of each language. But to some extent, there's people in Pakistan, as the higher up the class you go, which there's probably 95% English and 5% Urdu.
Yeah. Do you feel like you have a duty to conserve Urdu in a way? Like a really weird question to ask, but...
No, the way... Like, it's easier to conserve a language, not just through speaking it, but through being interested in its the culture that's being produced. I mean, ever since coming here and I was, like, introduced to friends and stuff, I started reading more Urdu poetry or listening to more Urdu ghazals. So stuff like that sort of engages your interest in the language as well. It's not like... I'm not saying that the use of English isn't warranted in Pakistan. I mean, most people don't know this. Like, in the subcontinent, English was introduced, like, in 1760s. So people were writing novels and, you know, poetry and... Not poetry, but novels and conversing and books within English, within the subcontinent. So our command over English is actually almost similar to our command over Urdu. But the problem is, you used to have that throughout, as the centuries progressed... You weren't losing that touch over Urdu ever since independence. Like, that command over Urdu has gone down and English has been transformed into this, like, class thing.
A random question, but what language do you dream in? Would it be Urdu or English?
I think it's both languages.
Okay.
Yeah. It's very interesting because I was saying this before the mic was on. How there's code switching in languages. I feel like there's also emotional switching. Like, there's certain emotions that I find myself can be better conveyed when I'm using Urdu, and I'll find myself automatically, like, switching to using Urdu when I'm experiencing those emotions. And, like, when I want to explain things very systematically and very, like, properly and, like, through a step-by-step thing, then I'll resort to English. But when it's, like, Urdu, it's... All of those emotions are coming out in a way that's feels very human when you're describing it to someone. Like, someone gets that... that intrinsic value of what you're going through when you're conversing in Urdu, I feel.
That's super interesting. Do you feel like your personality changes a little bit with each language?
Yeah, definitely. I think my personality with Urdu becomes a lot more at ease, a lot more, like, open, extroverted, outgoing. And whereas with English, it's very, like, calm and reserved. Yeah, especially when I meet someone for the first time. Like, I feel like if I'm meeting them and I'm talking in English, I'm very, like, downplaying. And then when it's in Urdu, it's much more open.
So if I were to ask you, hey, Hussein, do you want to get coffee after our lecture? How would you say that as a hybrid?
I would say, suno Hussein, tumko lecture ke baad coffee lene jaana hai? Which is, listen, Hussein. So I was trying to think, like, what could you say for hey? I don't think there's anything to substitute hey.
Really?
Yeah, it would be...
How would you say, like, hello? Or, like, what's, like, the introductory word usually?
Like, greetings.
Yeah.
You would say, like adab or assalamu alaikum. Yeah. I think the way that you say hey is very linked to religion. Like, if it was, like, let's say in Pakistan, if it was, like, a Muslim, then it would be assalamu alaikum. Or in Hindi, it would be dhanyavad, which is greetings. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. That sounds so much more beautiful than English. Because English is just like, hey, man, you know. That's really cool. Do you feel a frustration when you can't necessarily express yourself in one language and when you have to kind of, not necessarily compromise, but when you have to express yourself in ways that aren't exactly what you want to say? So you have to find, like, a route around that.
Yeah, definitely. There's, I don't know if it's a frustration, but there are points where I'm trying to express something and then it comes out and especially in English, where I'm trying to like say something and it'll come out in a way that makes me feel like, what did I just say? Like, in a way that makes me doubt my ability over English. Like, I don't know if that makes sense. It's like, even though if I'm writing an essay or I'm reading an article or I'm typing up something, like, my English is proper. It's like, I like grew up like learning it in school and everything and was exposed to English literature. But there'll be points where I'm speaking and it'll come out in a way that's making me think, like, what did I say? Not because what I said was wrong, but because I didn't think about it properly in my head, which made it, like, either grammatically incorrect or linguistically incorrect, something like that.
That's so
like,
interesting.
And especially, I think it's much more prevalent with English as opposed to Urdu. With Urdu, when I'm speaking, it's like, I don't have to think twice about it. I'll just say it. And I'll say it in very simple words, like very simple terms. But with English, it'll be like, it has to go through my brain in a way that I know what I want to say, but my brain is formulated in a way where it's skipping certain words or it's saying something which is doesn't like sound correct. And then I have to order it correctly and then I have to say it.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's super interesting. So like Urdu is more intuitive to you.
Yes, yeah.
Basically.
And I think that, again, it comes back from school, because when you're taught English in school, you're taught in a way that you have to think about it properly and you have to order it properly and you have to make sure it sounds proper before you actually go on and write it or talk about it.
Do you think you could write essays in Urdu?
I mean, I would like to. I mean, I'm like, especially recently since coming to university, I think I've like my exposure to Urdu has become much less. How do I say it? Like, much less on a friendly basis, but more on an academic basis. Like, I'm listening to more Urdu stuff, especially, like, or like which has increased my vocabulary. So, I mean, definitely, I would like to, like, learn how to read and write it, and maybe that would come to a point where I can write essays in Urdu. But not at this point, yeah.
Okay.
And I think that's true for a lot of people, especially the people I've met here. Again, like going back to class, I think it's true for a lot of people that are exposed to Urdu, that even though they're exposed to it and even though they've taken exams in it or they've studied it in school, I think there's a very few, very tiny proportion that would answer yes to your question, which is that they can engage with it in a critical and academic and intellectual way, like they engage with English.
Could you see yourself maybe learning more Urdu in the future? Because you say that you are now. Could you see yourself like getting more into touch with it to the point where you might be like, oh, actually, I feel more comfortable?
Yeah, there's definitely points where I think that I want to learn more Urdu, I think about it in a way that I want to engage with it academically. So there will be points where I'm considering, you know, like learning it online properly through a course as opposed to just learning it through home or through your parents, because I think that's what's missing for a lot of people that use these hybrid languages. The reason they're using is because maybe they've not been exposed to it in an academic and intellectual setting where it's just a language where you're conveying very complex thought processes.
That's really cool. Thank you so much.
No worries.
Thanks so much for listening to Crossing the Globe. This week's topic has been hybrid languages. I've been your presenter, Emma Di Carvalho. We've spoken to Ridian from Wales, Melissa from Hong Kong, and Hussein from Pakistan. The music has been by Ashley Layo Massing. If you'd like to share stories from your country, please become a contributor on the Beaver Facebook page. If you'd like to hear more, just check out the Beaver online.